Unlike the practical uniformity of pessimists, not all Buddhists line up on the same side, even in some of the broadest aspects of their beliefs. Ask Stephen Batchelor, author of Buddhism Without Beliefs. For instance, there are differing opinions among Buddhists regarding anatta, no self, and how it relates to reincarnation, because if there is no self, then what is it that gets reborn? To this question are loads of learned exegeses. One belief held by many Buddhists is that human beings are bits and pieces that add up to nothing, things of parts, hollow puppets, non-beings that think they are something they are not. Other Buddhists believe that this is only half the story. Things both exist and do not exist. Things are not what they seem, nor are they other than they seem. Things are many and they are one. Everything is nothing, including nothing. Along with every other religion, Buddhism is a compilation of do-it-yourself projects, and some of them, such as Pure Land Buddhism, are only lightweight versions of the faiths scantily detailed here. This principle has its parallel in every philosophy, ideology, and bag of myths that has ever been presented to the world. Because no two minds are contoured alike, no one system or collocation of systems will ever be sized to fit all. If truth is what you seek, then the examined life will only take you on a long ride to the limits of solitude and leave you by the side of the road with your truth and nothing else. This gives leave to believers in anything to have an opinion about whatever they like. For Buddhists, though, this is a problem, because clinging to opinions, or whatever else ordinary folk cling to, is an obstruction to becoming a right-minded practitioner of Buddhism. But you can believe that in Buddhist law, or in someone's opinion of Buddhist law, there are allowance conditions that stipulate when clinging is not really clinging. All religions must have allowance conditions, or they would implode upon themselves by the pressure of their own doctrines. Since Buddhism's only objective is attaining enlightenment, that high road to nirvana, it is at one with other religions in pitching a brighter future for believers in deliverance from the woes of this world. One problem, human beings are rarely so sensitive to the woes of this world that they feel a pressing need to reject all cravings for the pleasures of this world, as Buddhism would have them do. And it seems that any amount of pleasure is pleasure enough to get us to keep the faith that being alive is all right for everyone, or almost everyone, and will certainly be all right for any children we caused to be delivered into this world. How else could we stave off a craving to become extinct? The good news for Buddhism as a for-profit religion is that there are more than enough people who are sensitive to the woes of this world and who are willing to let go of their cravings for its pleasures, to seek the extinction of their everyday selves in the oasis of nirvana, absolute beatitude, permanent detachment from all attachment to a benighted way of life, a step-off from the cycle of death and rebirth, or whatever happy thing you like. Reaching this oasis may happen during an individual's lifetime, or could be delayed for the next round of reincarnation, when one will have another chance to cut oneself loose from karma, a doctrine that Buddhists borrowed from the Jains and the Hindus. Leaving aside reincarnation and the mental gymnastics it foists on the believer, the central focus of Buddhism's three-ring circus remains the state or non-state of enlightenment, which, like Jesus's ethereal theme park, is an appetizing carrot suspended in the darkness of life's suffering, if you are one of those who are sensitive enough to life's suffering. However, to get that carrot, you must first kowtow to dogmatic authorities that cannot be told apart from those of Christianity, spiritual ministers who strong-arm you to do some things and not do others under pain of not becoming enlightened. But here's the real catch. If you want to become enlightened, you will never become enlightened, because in Buddhism, wanting things is just the thing that keeps you from getting the thing you want. Less circuitously, if you want to end your suffering, you will never end your suffering. This is the wanting paradox, or paradox of desire, and Buddhists are at the ready with both rational and non-rational propositions as to why this paradox is not a paradox. How to understand these propositions is past understanding, because, per Buddhism, there is nothing to understand and no one to understand it. And as long as you think there is something to understand and someone to understand it, you are doomed. Trying for this understanding is the most trying thing of all. Yet trying not to try for it is just as trying. There is nothing more futile than to consciously look for something to save you. But consciousness makes this fact seem otherwise. Consciousness makes it seem as if, one, there is something to do, two, there is somewhere to go, three, there is something to be, four, there is someone to know. This is what makes consciousness the parent of all horrors, the thing that makes us try to do something, go somewhere, be something, and know someone, such as ourselves, so that we can escape our malignantly useless being and think that being alive is all right, rather than that which should not be. The Buddhist wanting paradox might be regarded as correlative to Zapfa's paradox, the paradox of conscious beings attempting to disclaim their consciousness of the flagrantly joyless possibilities of their lives. The difference between Buddhism's paradox and Zapfa's paradox is that the latter is not amenable to being resolved, explained away, or denied, either rationally or non-rationally. It can only be left unacknowledged, so that we can continue to live as we have all these years, or at least as long as we can before the paradox demands acknowledgment to the extent that we cannot live with ourselves as beings whose existence is terribly false and paradoxical, things so uncanny that we can no longer even look at one another or hold our heads steady. Until that day, we will keep living as obstinate selves who affirm that being conscious is an enlightened way to be, and that being alive is all right. In the marketplace of salvation, enlightenment seems the best buy ever offered, if only at first blush. Rather than floundering in a world that is not worth the emptiness it is written on, you may sign up to attain a conclusive vision of what's what and what's not. Broadly speaking, enlightenment is the correction of our consciousness and the establishment of a state of being in which muddy illusion is washed away and a diamond of understanding shines through. This is the supreme desert, if it may be had, if it has any reality outside the pat or cryptic locutions that advert to it. Millions of people have spent their lives, and some have even lost their minds, trying to win enlightenment without ever comprehending, as they sucked their last breath, what it was they had gambled to get. Had they attained enlightenment without being aware of it? Are there stages of enlightenment, maybe, depending on the type of Buddhism to which one subscribes, and how far had they gotten? In his One Taste, Daily Reflections on Integral Spirituality, Ken Wilber, a widely known and highly influential multidisciplinary scholar and theorist of spiritual traditions, reported that he asked one Zen Buddhist master, how many truly enlightened, deeply enlightened, Japanese Zen masters there were alive today? The master replied, not more than a dozen. Another Zen master put the number of fully enlightened individuals in the East at 1,000 throughout Zen Buddhism's history. Wilber's conclusion, thus, without in any way belittling the truly stunning contributions of the glorious Eastern traditions, the point is fairly straightforward. Radical, transformative spirituality is extremely rare anywhere in history and anywhere in the world. The numbers for the West are even more depressing. I rest my case. Indeed, enlightenment by Buddhism truly seems to be a well-defended redoubt whose location cannot be triangulated by speech, the only rule being that if you have to ask yourself if you have arrived, then it is certain you have not. Ego death. As we have heard, Buddhism's ways and means to illumination are full of shortcomings and vexations. Nevertheless, it does seem that some have reached a state corresponding to that of Buddhist enlightenment, as delineated in scads of scriptures, diaries, copyrighted publications, and public depositions. Curiously, these charmed individuals appear to have come to this state unwarned, sometimes as a result of physical trauma or a near-death experience, NDE. Perhaps the capital instance of enlightenment by accident is that of U.G. Krishnamurti. Although U.G. gave no credence to any doctrine of awakening, he claimed to have experienced clinical death at the age of 49, after which he returned to life as the kind of being glorified in the literature of enlightenment. Through his clinical death and its aftermath, which he called a calamity due to the pain and confusion he felt during this process, U.G. was transformed. For decades prior to his calamity, U.G. was an earnest seeker who sought enlightenment by effort rather than by accident. But his efforts got him nowhere, and he ended up financially drained. By chance, he met a woman who was willing to support him, and for years he was something of a layabout. It was while living with this woman that his calamity struck. Upon recovering from his calamity, he had what he once looked for and in disgust had given up trying to find. U.G. was no longer the person he once was. For now, he was someone whose ego had been erased. In this state, he had all the self-awareness of a tree frog. To his good fortune, he had no problem with his new way of functioning. He did not need to accept it, since by his report he had lost all sense of having an ego that needed to accept or reject anything. How could someone who had ceased to participate in the commerce of selves, who had inadvertently forfeited his personhood, believe or not believe in anything so outlandish as enlightenment, or any other spiritual vendibles, none of which are evident in the least, and all of which are as outmoded as the gods of antiquity or tribal deities with names that sounded comical to believers in real religions? While it may seem that U.G. had become a zombie, in a non-philosophical sense, his post-calamity life was nothing like that. Until his death in 2007, he spent much of his time berating people who came to him for spiritual succor. Cantankerous and opinionated, as some of the more famous masters of Zen Buddhism, U.G. arrestingly and often humorously told those who had made the pilgrimage to his door that everything they believed about anything was wrong. Few of them could get a word in edgewise, as he assassinated all that humanity has ever held sacred. Some would view U.G.'s disrespect for spirituality to be in happy rapport with the nature of enlightenment, which they have been taught cannot be pinned down by doctrines of any kind. Others would deny this assertion, perhaps because they have been indoctrinated to believe that both irreverence and deference toward the transcendent are off the mark once one has awakened. Neither side of this squabble would have tempted U.G. What he enunciated in interviews is the near impossibility of human beings, except perhaps one in a billion, to think of themselves only as animals born to survive and reproduce. As Zapfe had written long before U.G. began slurring every belief in the world, mental activity beyond the basic programs of our animalism has led only to suffering. In the beast, suffering is self-confined. In man, it knocks holes into a fear of the world and a despair of life. U.G. never spoke of a solution for what consciousness has made of our lives. We are captured by illusions, and there is no way out. That U.G. came upon a way out, as he told his countless interrogators, was nothing but luck, nothing he knew anything about or could pass on to others. Yet they still came to him and asked for his help. To their pleas, he immediately replied he could not help them, nor could they help themselves. No help could be had from any sector in which they searched. They could seek deliverance their entire lives and make it all the way to their deathbeds with nothing but the same useless questions and useless answers with which they began. U.G. had his, but they would never get theirs. So, why should they go on living? Naturally, no one bluntly posed this question to Yuji. But they had his answer. There is no you that lives, only a body going about its business of being alive and obeying biology. Whenever someone asked Yuji how they could become like him, he always replied it would be impossible for them even to desire to become like him, because their motive for wanting to be like him was self-interested, and as long as they believed in a self that was interested in canceling itself, that self would want to keep itself alive and thus would not want to know ego death. Whatever people did with their lives was of no concern to Yuji, as he tirelessly recapitulated to those who engaged him in conversation. He did not see his himself as a sage with spiritual merchandise to sell. That was for the mountebanks of salvation who infested the world with their codified sects, each baring its teeth to defend some trademarked trumpery. Yuji is not the only known case of enlightenment by accident. A quite singular instance of the experience in question is that of the Australian physicist John Wren Lewis, a non-religious man who nearly died of poisoning and woke up in a hospital in a state of enlightenment he never requested or pained himself to earn. Both Yuji and Wren Lewis publicly emphasized the unsought nature of their illumination. Both also warned against gurus with recipes for enlightenment. In talks with interviewers, Yuji, who did not write books, lambasted every religious figure known to humanity as a fraud. After his own awakening, Wren Lewis became overtaken by the possible connection between enlightenment phenomena and NDEs. His way of thinking, for what it might be worth, parallels Zapfa's in that it identifies ordinary consciousness as a basic malfunction that is some kind of inflation or hyperactivity of the psychological survival system. He derived hope that this malfunction could be repaired from the fact that NDEers are sometimes relieved from death anxiety by having their egoistic consciousness commuted into an impersonal consciousness of an enlightened sort. None of this is to say that reports of NDE experience are any more believable than, let us say, those of alien abductions. Leniently interpreted, however, they may foretell that our species has an outside chance at a future without extinction-fearing egos, since the human race will never do the honorable thing and abort itself. Perhaps some day we will be individually fixed to die without an unbecoming fight to the death. A stereotypical report of an NDE is related by businessman and author Tim Horwitz in his essay, My Death, Reflections on My Journey into Non-Being. In the course of describing his transformation following his death as a result of anaphylactic shock in September 1995, Horwitz wrote, "There was no vestige of self-importance left. It felt like death had obliterated my ego, the attachments I had, my history, and who I had been. Death had been very democratic. It had eliminated innumerable distinctions. With one bold stroke, my past had been erased. I had no identity in death. It didn't stay erased. Some would say that this was the real tragedy. But it was erased for a time. Gone was my personal history with all of its little vanities. The totality of myself was changed. The me was much smaller and much more compact than it had been. All that there was right in front of me. I felt incredibly light. Personality was a vanity, an elaborate delusion, a ruse. Compared with U.G. Krishnamurti and John Wren Lewis, Horwitz had only a slight case of ego death following his clinical death. Soon afterward, he was cured of the erasure of his identity. Another statistic of long-term ego death was Suzanne Siegel, who one day found she had become bereft of herself. After years of seeking a cure to the unease this experience had set off in her, it would seem that not everybody is at peace with being nobody. She wrote, "Collision with the Infinite, A Life Beyond the Personal Self." The following year, she died of a brain tumor at the age of 42. Although no link was established between her diseased brain and the disappearance of her ego, cerebral tumors causing altered states of consciousness and changes in personality are not unknown. Unlike Yuji, but similar to Ren Lewis, Siegel sought answers to her transformation in spiritual traditions that addressed egoless experience. Unlike Ren Lewis, but similar to Yuji, Siegel had pursued a spiritual practice, transcendental meditation, before she became the beneficiary of enlightenment by accident. Siegel lost her ego 2 years after discontinuing TM, which she performed for 8 years. In an interview, she stated that she did not feel meditation played a role in the loss of her self-identity. Yuji was in agreement with Siegel. After years of pursuing ego death through meditation, he railed against this procedure as pointless and perhaps harmful. For most of humanity, including that part which studies consciousness, the phenomenon of ego death is not enthralling or even well marked as a human experience. Ordinary folk have all their big questions answered to their satisfaction by some big book. And cognitive psychologists, philosophers of mind, and neuroscientists have their reputations to consider as high priests of the noosphere. Quite naturally, then, almost no one figures their time to be ill-spent in bickering about some point of scripture or a psycho-philosophical poser, rather than in sizing up some superlative individuals who have called into question what we are or what we might be aside from slaves of our egos. Regardless of the life stories of Yuji, Ren Lewis, and Suzanne Siegel, ego death is a state that has nothing but anecdotal evidence to support it, which groups this phenomenon with mystical experiences and revealed religions. As one might imagine, though, ego death is laden with about as much mass appeal as physical death. It has been eyeballed as an ideal only by a minuscule number of our species who feel there is something wrong with ego life, which they conceive as an uncanny masquerade, where things they would rather not see are behind every false face. To everyone else, life is life, and death is death. We are not sold on impersonal survival. It would negate all that we are, or think we are, for what are we but egos itching to survive? And once our egos have been deposed, what would be left of us? By all recorded accounts, everything would be left, except what Horwitz called a vanity, an elaborate delusion, a ruse. Some would say that if human beings must exist, the condition in which Yuji, Ren Lewis, and Siegel found themselves is the optimum model, one in which everyone's ego has been overthrown and our consciousness of ourselves as persons goes up in smoke. As Siegel tried to explain what had happened to her, the experience of living without a personal identity, without an experience of being somebody, an I or a me, is exceedingly difficult to describe, but it is absolutely unmistakable. It can't be confused with having a bad day, or coming down with the flu, or feeling upset, or angry, or spaced out. When the personal self disappears, there is no one inside who can be located as being you. The body is only an outline, empty of everything of which it had previously felt so full. The mind, body, and emotions no longer referred to anyone. There was no one who thought, no one who felt, no one who perceived. Yet the mind, body, and emotions continued to function unimpaired. Apparently, they did not need an I to keep doing what they always did. Thinking, feeling, perceiving, speaking, all continued as before, functioning with a smoothness that gave no indication of the emptiness behind them. No one suspected that such a radical change had occurred. All conversations were carried on as before. Language was employed in the same manner. Questions could be asked and answered, cars driven, meals cooked, books read, phones answered, and letters written. As the ego dead, so we might imagine, we would continue to know pain in its various forms, that is the essence of existence, but we would not be cozened by our egos to take it personally, an attitude that converts an individual's pain into conscious suffering. Naturally, we would still have to feed, but we would not be omnivorous gourmands who eat for amusement, gorging down everything in nature and turning to the laboratory for more. As for reproduction, who can say? Animals are driven to copulate, and even as the ego dead, we would not be severed from biology, although we would not be unintelligently ruled by it, as we are now. As a corollary of not being unintelligently ruled by biology, neither would we sulk over our extinction, as we do now. Why raise another generation destined to climb aboard the evolutionary treadmill? But then, why not raise another generation of the ego dead? For those who do not perceive either their pleasures or their pains as belonging to them, neither life nor death would be objectionable or not objectionable, desirable or not desirable, all right or not all right. We would be the ego dead, the selfless, and, dare we say, the enlightened. A depiction of what our lives might be like in such a state would seem to have been recorded in the 80th section of the Tao Te Ching, perhaps to show up humankind's modus vivendi by daydreaming about one not of this earth. Let all lands be small and their people few, so they have no need for time-saving machines. Let them keep their minds on the coming of death and never stray far from where they were born. Should they have boats or carts to go traveling, let there be nothing they would want to see. Should they have weapons, let them be put someplace out of everyone's sight to rust and grow useless. Let each person's duties be no more than may be kept track of by tying knots on a short piece of string. Let their food be enough, and their clothes drab, their homes decent shelter, and their lives unremarkable. If the next land is so close that they can hear its dogs barking at night and its roosters crowing at dawn, let them get old and die rather than be troubled by the least curiosity to have a look over there. One might think of this not as a description of an ego-dead society, but of one that is dead all the way. But one would be wrong. Wherever there are those who get old and die, there are also those who live in wait for age and for death, youths and infants to be. And because none of them should take his fate personally in the Taoist scripture quoted, why not take it as it comes? Of course, this would not occur to the ego dead, just as it does not occur to species of a lower order that recycle themselves as nature bids them. The ego dead would be back to where our race began, surviving, reproducing, dying. Nature's way would be restored in all its mindlessness and puppetry. But even if ego death is regarded as the optimum model for human existence, one of liberation from ourselves, it still remains a compromise with being, a concession to the blunder of creation itself. We should be able to do better, and we can. To have our egos killed off is second best to killing off death and all the squalid byplay that flitters around it. So let all lands be small, and let them grow smaller and smaller until no lands are left where any human footstep need press itself upon the earth. At the height of her ego death, Siegel was ecstatic 24 hours a day. She also began to speak of what she called the vastness, a term that sounds as if it belongs in one of Lovecraft's tales of cosmic horror. To Siegel, the vastness was a unitary phenomenon that comprised all existence. As she wrote, the purpose of human life has been revealed. The vastness created these human circuitries in order to have an experience of itself out of itself that it couldn't have without them. Living in the vastness as she did, nothing was useless to Siegel because it served the purposes of the vastness. For her, it also felt good once she had gotten over her initial fear of being a tool of the vastness rather than a person. However, toward the end of her life, as American psychotherapist and Buddhist Stephen Bodian recounts in his afterword to Collision with the Infinite, Siegel began to have more intense experiences in which the vastness became even vaster for itself. This new phase of the vastness both distressed her emotionally and sapped her physical energy until she died from her unsuspected brain tumor not long afterward. Like Siegel's vastness, Schopenhauer's will has the same purpose in mind for human beings, to use our circuitries to acquire some kind of knowledge of its mindless self. For Schopenhauer, though, the self-seeking will does not feel good to human beings except during moments when we temporarily satisfy its universal ravening as it emerges within us. Why the vastness or the will should want to use us in this way is a mystery. Both of these meta-realities do serve the purpose of making sense of human life in their own way. But whether they make us feel good does not seem to matter to either of them. We are just vehicles, they are the drivers, and wherever we are going, as Siegel and Schopenhauer have assured us, along with every other individual whose consciousness has been opened to the vastness by whatever name or nature, we must keep in mind that we are not what we think we are. Taking things a step further, Professor Nobody would teach us that neither is our world what we think it is, lecturing with a flamboyant dispassion on the omnipresence of the infernal in The Eyes That Never Blink. Mist on a lake, fog in thick woods, a golden light shining on wet stones, such sights make it all very easy. Something lives in the lake, rustles through the woods, inhabits the stones or the earth beneath them. Whatever it may be, this something lies just out of sight, but not out of vision for the eyes that never blink. In the right surroundings, our entire being is made of eyes that dilate to witness the haunting of the universe. But really, do the right surroundings have to be so obvious in their spectral atmosphere? Take a cramped waiting room, for instance. Everything there seems so well anchored in normalcy. Others around you talk ever so quietly. The old clock on the wall is sweeping aside the seconds with its thin red finger. The window blinds deliver slices of light from the outside world and shuffle them with shadows. Yet, at any time and in any place, our bunkers of banality may begin to rumble. You see, even in a stronghold of our fellow beings, we may be subject to abnormal fears that would land us in an asylum if we voiced them to another. Did we just feel some presence that does not belong among us? Do our eyes see something in a corner of that room in which we wait for we know not what? Just a little doubt slipped into the mind, a little trickle of suspicion in the bloodstream, and all those eyes of ours, one by one, open up to the world and see its horror. Then no belief or body of laws will guard you. No friend, no counselor, no appointed personage will save you. No locked door will protect you. No private office will hide you. Not even the solar brilliance of a summer day will harbor you from horror. For horror eats the light and digests it into darkness.